The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit kywnewsradio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
Welcome to our weekly look at the stories making headlines in Philadelphia and the rest of the region. I'm Brian Seltzer, filling in for Matt Leon this week. Over the next hour, our KYW News Radio reporting team breaks down some of the biggest headlines from the past 7 days. PECO's union ends its strike and cashes in on some timely leverage.
The lights will go back on faster if those PECO workers are paid fairly.
Nigel Thompson explains how IBEW Local 614 seemed to score a major victory in a historic standoff. Camden got hit hard by last weekend's rains in a part of town that's not really considered a flood risk.
Dozens of cars were flooded out.
Mike Doherty has more on the cleanup efforts. Mayor Parker wanted her big July 4th bash to leave a legacy, but the showers came and a major headliner bailed.
You have to consider the wisdom of putting taxpayer money into something so ephemeral as an outdoor concert in July in Philadelphia.
Pat Loeb tells us whether the city will be stuck footing Christina Aguilera's bill. Our crime and justice reporter, Kristen Johansson, caught up with Philly's top cop this week to talk about how community involvement is cutting down on gun violence.
The power dynamic has shifted. There's ownership now for, I think, many residents.
Arson is being blamed for a fire at a Northeast Philly mosque. The result? A citywide interfaith rallying cry.
Across the board, the message was one of support for the Muslim community.
Matt Coughlin checks in. And from festive concessions to plenty of fan events, the city is getting ready for Major League Baseball All-Star Week.
I've been looking forward to this for years, Brian.
Of course we booked Mike DiNardo for a preview. Who else? The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio starts right after this. PECO is plenty used to power issues, just not quite like this.
As of 12:01 a.m. on July 4th, IBEW Local 614 workers are going on strike.
I'm Brian Seltzer, filling in for Matt Leon this week on The Week in Philly. And for the first time ever in the history of a company dating back to the 1880s, PECO had a strike on its hands. Members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 614 walked off the job July 4th and held the picket line for 3 days, rain and all. In the end, it was enough for them to get what they wanted from Pennsylvania's largest energy provider as the sides came to a tentative agreement on Tuesday. KYW News Radio's Nigel Thompson covered the strike for us and what had to qualify Nigel as the shortest distance you have ever had to cover for a story here, I would presume, because headquarters across the street from our headquarters at 2400 Market Street.
Especially because the day before I was out roving the collar counties for storm damage.
Nigel, what finally brought the strike to an end?
From somebody who covered kind of the whole process of the strike, it seems as very much as though that like PECO kind of gave in to the public pressure that was being put on them by the picketing union members. They launched it on a holiday weekend, July 4th, and then it just happened to be on July 4th when we got some really bad storms that did its number on the 4th of July events. But, you know, across the collar counties, across the city, thousands of people lost power. PECO said they had a contingency plan and they sent out contractors at first, but I think that was never going to be the long-term plan. And so they very much, you know, sat down and started kind of ceding ground to the negotiators for IBEW Local 614.
Could you get the sense in covering the picket line that the union felt like that was a major break in terms of momentum for them, that they really were able to gain some leverage with all the weather incidents that were taking place?
I mean, absolutely. Like I talked to a number of them and they all were bringing up like, hey, yeah, we're important for weekends like this. A lot of the workers that were on strike were, you know, your call center dispatchers that are dispatching people to outages, to down trees, to fix power lines, you know, the linesmen that are actually fixing it with gas workers and other workers. So like these were the people that would be out in these storms, working long hours, putting their bodies on the line for that. And that just tied like almost perfectly into the story of like what they're fighting for, which was, you know, just I think on their end, more respect from PECO.
Take us a little bit beneath that for people who might not have been following the origins of the labor strife here. Just how big of a union is IBEW Local 614? And what were some of the specific sticking points they wanted in this new deal?
You know, they represent about 1,600 PICO workers. And the big thing they wanted is just increased wages, forcing PICO to hit an industry standard in terms of benefits, in terms of pay. The other I would say is they wanted medical coverage in retirement. And then they also just wanted their retirement plan sort of restructured. And they ended up getting like a cash balance pension plan. So in the end, they were very, very happy because they got everything they wanted. This is Union President Larry Anastasi.
It is a magnificent day for the proud, proud, brave members of IBEW Local 614.
Another thing that kind of ties into this is, you know, they had been working without a contract since April 1st. And not long ago, not long after that contract expired, PICO's like earnings came out and PICO had, you know, reported like a massive increase in earnings, you know, year over year, especially last year. And so that frustrated a lot of people within the union of like, hey, man, like you guys are making all this money. Why can't we get a bigger piece of that pie? You know, considering all the work that we do, all the hours that we pour in.
What about PICO? How is PICO framing this? What have we heard from them?
PICO is framing this as we respect our workers. You know, we're grateful for IBEW 614 to go through this process with us. We credit both the bargaining units for coming to a good deal. One of the statements that they put out on Tuesday, it was this deal reinforces both the union's commitment and our commitment to not only having workplace safety and valuing the commitment of our workers, but also, you know, the reliable and affordable service that we can provide customers.
Will a happier workforce make for more satisfied customers, a better product, do you think?
I think history, no matter the industry that you're in, will tell you that. The lights stay on and the lights will go back on faster if those PICO workers are paid fairly, treated fairly, and get the benefits that they want.
KYW News Radio's Nigel Thompson. Great coverage. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And the Week in Philly is just getting started. More on flooding in Camden and some tea that has been spilled in the aftermath of Philly's big July 4th concert. It was supposed to be a weekend of celebration. Instead, it turned into the start of a massive cleanup. I'm Brian Seltzer, in for Matt Leon this week on The Week in Philly. July 4th storms brought really bad flooding to Camden. KYW News Radio South Jersey reporter Mike Doherty visited the Parkside neighborhood earlier this week. Check out the damage. Mike, what'd you see?
Oh, it was a mess. Haddon Avenue near Park was just, it looked like kind of a war zone. You know, the road was sort of turned into a river. I spoke with the owner of a corner store, you know, kind of a bodega type place, JYM supermarket, Daniel Duran.
We were getting a lot of water coming into the basement through the windows, through the cracks of the wall, through the door. A lot of the product was overflowing and just spoiled. You know, we keep the spirits high and we're smiling, but really, it's been really stressful.
I didn't get down into the basement, but I kind of peeked through the doorway. They were pumping it out, but there was feet of water, stuff floating all around. He said he had his refrigerator motors were down there. They were all shot. He expects this is going to be tens of thousands, probably in the ballpark of $50,000 worth of damage when all said and done. But they're open. He said the community's coming by, supporting them. You know, you see other people up and down the street sort of sweeping out their front walks. You see hoses coming out of basements for pumping. And this isn't near the river, by the way. It wasn't like right along the Delaware River where you might expect to see flooding or something. This was further in. There was a lot of water there. Dozens of cars were flooded out. And this kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Mike. Can we get into that a little bit more? What was it that triggered such bad flooding in this specific part of Camden?
Well, we don't really know. They haven't done a full sort of accounting of what went wrong there. But the road there has been under construction. They're working on a lot of the infrastructure. And I don't know what's going on underground. But the store owner, Daniel, said he thinks that some of the road work kind of mucked up the drainage system there. Whereas, you know, in other parts of the city, and Governor Sherrill mentioned it, that they have made recent upgrades and have better stormwater management in some locations. And that's why some of the waters were better able to sort of disperse from there. But this Haddon Avenue section, it's still under construction. You know, I was there, I saw a PSE&G crews halfway in the ground, and it looks like, you know, they're not finished with whatever they're working on there. And that might have been a contributing factor.
situation serious enough for Governor Sherrill to scope it out herself? What were her takeaways?
She was happy with a lot of the response, and she highlighted the city had just recently, within the last week or two, received a high water rescue vehicle. The fire department received more than 1,000 calls to come and help people out. And she said that they did a great job of ensuring that everyone kind of was rescued from those high water areas, that there was no major, injuries or loss of life, which is obviously the main objective. You can fix property, you can't fix a loss of life. So she was pleased with the way the fire department and the city handled the response. Obviously, Mother Nature is Mother Nature. You can't control what happens. You can only control your response. And Sherrill was pleased with what she saw there.
Any sense yet, Mike, whether or not there's going to be any type of financial relief available for residents, business owners, because of the damage that the storm last weekend caused?
Yeah, for sure. We don't know exactly what people are going to be eligible for, but the governor encouraged everyone to go to the Office of Emergency Management and fill out their damage application sheets, make sure that everything is accounted for so that there's a full, a full rundown of what they need to ask for. And then from there, the federal and the state and local relief programs can take effect and they can, sort of begin the paperwork process, which is complicated.
That's KYW News Radio South Jersey reporter Mike Doherty. A little bit later on, a preview of Philadelphia's next big sporting event of the summer, Major League Baseball's All-Star Game, and all the activities you can enjoy surrounding it, whether you've got a ticket or not. Stay with us.
It's the Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
I want to see Meek Mill, and I want to see Christina Aguilera. It's very exciting to see the city pulling out all the stops.
I love how there's so much going on in this town.
There was a marathon concert, plenty of rain, an unprecedented fireworks show into the wee hours of the morning, and now some spilled tea, too. I'm Brian Seltzer, sitting in for Matt Leon on The Week in Philly. The One Philly United for America July 4th concert was one to remember on the Parkway for a lot of reasons. KYW News Radio City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joins us now to pick up a few of the pieces. Pat, the crowds, for the most part, stuck it out. One big headliner did not.
Yes, Christina Aguilera apparently had a fantastic show planned. Her Instagram story shows her rehearsing with an orchestral string session with a troupe of dancers singing America the Beautiful, the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. And when you think about putting all that work in and getting rained out, it's a little heartbreaking. But she did make the call that it was not going to happen after that downpour.
Yeah, and of course, the city paid a fee for Christina Aguilera to perform. Is the city left now to foot the bill for her coming into town but not playing?
Yes, she had a contract and she is going to get paid. Now, city officials who are not authorized to speak on the record say the city plans to negotiate how much and possibly to try to get Aguilera to come back and do a show at a later date. We don't know what Aguilera's contract said. We have no accounting of how much the city paid the producer, ESM, which it hired, because the mayor had it in her head that this concert was going to be the event legacy. Now, let me explain about legacy. The Please Touch Museum is in a magnificent building in Fairmount Park that was built as the main exposition hall for the centennial of the country. The Ben Franklin Bridge was devised and completed for the sesquicentennial 50 years later. For the bicentennial 50 years ago, the city opened the African American Museum, the Mummers Museum, and a living history museum, which did not last but now houses the city's public broadcasting stations. Now, the mayor has said many times that no one planned ahead for this semi-quincentennial. And so when she came into office, just 2.5 years ago, there was no fund for a legacy project, and the timeline was too short to create one. So she decided this concert was going to be such a happening that it would be a legacy that people would always remember and want to go and say they were there. Woodstock, if you will. But you have to consider the wisdom of putting taxpayer money into something so ephemeral as an outdoor concert in July in Philadelphia? You know, the concert was really just part of what was, in fact, a very huge celebration that I think people who were anywhere in the city will remember. Remember, we talked so much about public safety beforehand, you know, tabletop exercises with Homeland Security. That part of it went off beautifully. I don't know if it was over preparation or just the right amount, but it was a safe celebration.
That was over the weekend, July 4th weekend. On Monday, the big news that came out from all of this was that Welcome America CEO Michael DelBene announcing abruptly his resignation. Any clues as to why?
Yes, but their clue is no one is talking on the record. So with that disclaimer, I will say I think it is related to the mayor taking over the concert, taking Welcome America's name off of the concert. And maybe because he didn't have to do a concert, DelBene thought he'd have extra time on his hands. He took a second job, a second very big job, running FanFest for the entire length of the FIFA World Cup on Lemon Hill. So I think there was a little bit of animosity on both sides, both from the Welcome America board for DelBene taking that job, but DelBene perhaps even taking the job in the first place because of the city's direct intervention in what is always kind of the big moment of 4th of July in Philadelphia.
There were so many big events that were planned for the city this summer. How is the city feeling like everything's gone so far?
Oh, yeah. I mean, during the hosting duties of the city, when you had large groups of people from other countries just kind of walking around the city and really seeming to dig it, just happy to be here, eating in the restaurants, to have these big events like all of the Brazil fans taking over the art museum steps. It was just a wonderful atmosphere in the city. And FanFest was very popular and is still continuing until the whole World Cup is over. And I was on Independence Mall on 4th of July, and it was such a scene. It was so American. There was a long line to get in to see the Liberty Bell, people all dressed in red, white, and blue. And then there were protesters. You know, there were people defending the president's house, which is still half up. And there was a group called Veterans Against Endless War and Domestic Deployment. It was very, very American. And there were tons of people. And yes, it was hot. It was sweaty. It was terrible. But it just felt really good.
As always, excellent perspective and context from KYW News Radio City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. Pat, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Philly's top cop has the latest on new gun violence stats. This is The Week in Philly.
We are building that partnership with the community and embracing that. We want them to be a part of our strategy.
Philadelphia is making major progress on the gun violence front. What does it mean? I'm Brian Seltzer, filling in for Matt Leon this week on The Week in Philly. And the stats back it up. Gun homicides are down. But how do we reconcile that trend when there's still plenty of tragedies affecting neighborhoods throughout the city? KYW News Radio crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson is here to take a look at the numbers. Kristen, what are they telling us?
So believe it or not, as we sit July 9th, there have been still fewer than 100 homicides in Philadelphia, which is something that we haven't seen. They say since the 50s and 60s, although things are categorized differently. But to give you kind of a taste of what it was like about 5 or 6 years ago, in 2021, there was 319 homicides at this point in the year. So we are starkly at a different place than we were even a few years ago. And shootings, I should mention, are also down. There's been about 350-ish, you know, I mean, every day it changes. But there were about 1,200 shootings by the first week of July, just in 2022. So that's a fraction of what we normally see when it comes to gun violence victims.
And underscoring these numbers, right, is the fact that we're in the midst of the summer season now.
Right. And one of the things that kind of a couple of us, you know, in that crime and justice world talked about is for several years, there were these mass shootings or mass incidents where multiple people were shot. And so there's been kind of these bigger incidents that have happened. This has really been the first weekend in a very long time. We did have shootings. We did have homicides. There are still victims. There are still grieving families. But there wasn't that kind of mass casualty event, which obviously is encouraging. And again, it's just about knocking on wood.
You mentioned the stark contrast in the stats between now and 5 years ago. 5 years ago, there was a different mayor, a different police chief. Does that have something to do with this? What are some of the other factors that when you take a look at the whole picture, you would attribute to the trends that we're seeing?
There's so much. There really can't be just the one thing, just from what I've seen. And there wasn't one causation for when it was, you know, so high. It was high across the country, you know, especially like around COVID in 21, 22, and it was really the highest it ever has been. I mean, one thing, the detectives doing so much work with this and a lot of, you know, technology with cell phones, obviously video, surveillance video, just combing through all of that, have that clearance rate. But then there's also the Gun Violence Task Force, which is a partnership between the district attorney's office and the AG's office. And many of these shootings that were happening around the pandemic and in certain parts of the neighborhood, certain pockets of that area were happening between gangs and gang violence. So it is the investigators and it is the prosecutors that work in hand with them at all levels of government. Just sometimes by taking off the street one or two people that may be involved in kind of that violence, sometimes that just silences kind of the dust up or the argument that happens. And I think that that, of course, over time, getting the people that are really the ones that do the violence, getting them off the streets has had the biggest impact. But I will note that the police commissioner, Kevin Bethel, says that he gives a lot of credit to the people of the city.
We're more likely to put out a photo and say, help me find this individual. Provide me with a last name, or even if you don't know where there is, someplace that they hang. You know, those things have been absolutely invaluable in how we've been able to be successful.
And he says that those people have really been, you know, calling in with tips to the police officers. He actually said that he's been signing a lot of those $20,000 rewards for homicides for, you know, information leading to an arrest and conviction. He said he's been signing quite a few and the clearance rate is dramatically up.
Let's talk more about the people who have been affected by gun violence in this city. You have the victims and their families, their friends, their neighborhoods. This is still years and years of scarring and trauma that's taken place. Do these numbers, trends, do they matter to these people at all?
Oh, I absolutely think so. And also, I think there's, it's funny you're asking that question because I talked about this with the commissioner. I was saying it almost feels like the people are getting their power back. You know, before, especially during the pandemic, we did a lot of stories with people kind of saying that they're staying inside, that they're just fearful of the gun violence outside and what was going on outside. So they're staying inside. They don't want to be a part of it. Now it feels like they're taking back their own neighborhoods and they're saying, you know what? That guy on the block, he's been a problem. I'm going to call him with the tip. I'm going to, you know, get a block captain, or I'm going to talk to the block captain, or I'm going to call a community group. I'm going to call somebody I know. And they're just, the power dynamic has shifted. There's ownership now for, I think, many residents in Philadelphia.
Another big story on your beat this week, Kristen, a house essentially in squalor in the Northeast, children and animals involved.
Brian, this is one of the saddest stories I've done, truthfully. So the FBI raided a home on Whitaker Avenue for a separate investigation. I'm told by sources that was part of a terrorism type of investigation, not necessarily Homeland Security type of terrorism. But agents go in and they discover in this horrible house that has bug infested kind of conditions, no running water, no electricity, trash on the ground, feces from cats and a dog everywhere, urine everywhere. They find a little 5-year-old girl and her 8-month-old sister living in this house. And on top of that, they found at least 4 dozen cats living at that property and a dog that was mostly in its crate most of the time. The authorities put those children in DHS custody. Their parents, Megan Bach and Thomas Bach, both now face 2 counts of endangering welfare of children, 2 counts of reckless endangerment, as well as conspiracy and weapons offenses. I spoke with the director of animal law enforcement with the PSPCA, the Pennsylvania SPCA, Nicole Wilson, and she says that they're going to be going back to the property a few times to just make sure that they have all of the animals.
KYW News Radio crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson, always keeping us informed. We're going to stay in the Northeast and look at how the Philly religious community is rallying around an apparent arson at a mosque. Stay with us on The Week in Philly.
The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic at HRV from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand.
This mosque is our second home. No place of worship should ever be a target of hate.
I urge law enforcement at every level to investigate whether this was motivated by anti-Muslim bias.
What happened there is heartbreaking. Hate would not divide our community.
The community deserves a full and honest answer.
In the face of fire, a community rallies. This is The Week in Philly. I'm Brian Seltzer. Matt Leon has the week off. Early Sunday morning, a fire broke out at the Northeast Philadelphia Islamic Center along Tyson Avenue right off Castor. By the end of the week, the incident had become a catalyst for interfaith support. KYW News Radio's Matt Coughlin has been following this story. And Matt, take us back to early last Sunday morning. What happened?
From what we understand, someone was walking past the mosque and appears to have thrown something inside, igniting the fire. A neighbor who leaders at the mosque praised highly called 911 and firefighters came. They were able to put out the fire. There is a lot of damage, particularly to the front of the building. Police are looking for whoever that person is that started the fire. They have said this is an arson.
Any injuries? Was anyone in the mosque at the time the fire happened?
No, nobody was inside the building. No one was injured. A lot of people spoke about how wonderful that was, but at the same time, the need to rebuild, to repair, and to heal the community.
What other details do we have about how police started to piece together that there was criminal activity here?
The CARE organization was able to find some video and share that with police. CARE is the Council on American Islamic Relations support activist group for the Muslim community, and they've been very vocal since this occurred.
The incident happened on Sunday morning. By Wednesday, this apparent arson had become a rallying cry for many religious communities and political leaders within Philadelphia. What type of turnout was there by midweek? Who was all involved in trying to help the mosque begin to heal and repair?
Sure. There was a very, very emotional day on Wednesday. Wednesday afternoon, Omar Sabir, he's the chairman of the Philadelphia County Commissioners, organized what you might say is a rally or a call for aid and justice in this situation.
The mosque has served this community since 2004 and has grown to hundreds of worshipers. Even as it raises money to build something larger, someone tried to answer that growth with fire. And it came the very weekend our nation marked 250 years since its freedom and our Constitution, freedom to worship. An attack on any house of worship is an attack on the civic fabric of Philadelphia.
Dozens upon dozens of imams, rabbis, pastors, all faiths were there, as well as political leaders, a number of city council members, representatives of the mayor's office, the governor's office, state reps, state senators, and I believe a representative from the House of Representatives.
Anything strike you about what was said, the tone of what was said?
Across the board, there were several speakers. And across the board, the message was one of support for the Muslim community in Northeast Philadelphia, support for the masjid, the Islamic center there in the Northeast, and a call for justice, for police to consider whether this was indeed a hate crime.
We are grateful that no one was injured, but we now face the unexpected challenges of the rebuilding. The mosque is served our community for decades as a place of worship, education, and service. We are determined to rebuild and continue the mission.
There's a GoFundMe to help them rebuild. At last check, had several thousand dollars. They had a ways to go to get where they hope to be, but they're hoping to raise money to help make repairs there at the masjid.
Where do things stand with the investigation at this point?
Philadelphia police authorities say they are still investigating, looking for the individual who started this fire. Now, there is a reward. During the event on Wednesday, Omar Sabir pledged another $2,500 towards that. There's money from CARE involved and police. So the total reward for information leading to the arrest, capture, and conviction of whoever started that fire is now at $10,000.
KYW News Radio's Matt Coughlin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Philadelphia is taking center stage in the baseball universe the next 2 days with the Home Run Derby and All-Star Game, but some of the festivities are already underway. Mike DiNardo joins us next to talk about all the different activations around the city and what to expect and eat at the park on The Week in Philly.
There are going to be a million All-Star Games after 2026, but none are going to have the significance or the spotlight of this one.
There will be plenty of hometown flavor during Major League Baseball's All-Star Week at Citizens Bank Park. We're not just talking about the six Phillies that'll be participating. I'm Brian Seltzer. Our resident baseball fanatic Mike DiNardo had some plum assignments this week touring Citizens Bank Park and previewing some other events ahead of the 2026 All-Star Game. But who would have thought, Mike, that a sandwich, of all things, has stolen the headlines?
You know, the biggest news, at least in my opinion, to come out of the ballpark preview was the return of the Schmitter, that steak and cheese and fried salami and cheese and tomato and cheese treasure from McNally's Tavern in Chestnut Hill. Of course, it was originally sold at the ballpark, but hasn't been since 2015, not because of demand, but because of quality control concerns. Well, the Schmitter is back, not only for the All-Star Game, but for the remainder of this season. You'll find it at Pass and Stow. This is great news for Phillies fans and cardiologists all over the Delaware Valley.
Well, this is such a big event. First time the All-Star Game is in Philadelphia since 1996. Is it true that there are over 400 pieces of exclusive merch that are going to be available at the park for the event?
I didn't count them, but there was a table with much of the All-Star Game merch. A lot of it is the regular merch with the All-Star Game logo, but we did see things like a Ben Franklin head that I believe was a mug or a cup, and of course, Fanatic-themed All-Star things.
That's some of the stuff happening at CBP. Now, at the convention center, there is the All-Star Village, kind of like a fan fest for anyone who remembers back to what was held there in 1996. What'll be going on there this year?
There is a lot more tech in this year's village. They have virtual batting cages where folks can take part in a virtual reality home run derby. There are places where you can put on a Velcro suit and stick yourself to an outfield wall for a photo of yourself robbing a home run if you want to. But there's plenty of also low-tech things that are going on at the village, too. There are places to get player autographs. There are places to take pictures with legends of the game, displays for Latino legends and the Negro Leagues and women in baseball. There's a mascot derby. There's food from all over the major leagues, a selection from each ballpark. And we should say there is a local flavor to this village. There are five neighborhoods in Philadelphia that are represented here. Those neighborhoods are Center City, Fishtown, South Philly, Old City, and Fairmount. Each is complete with a custom mural.
Awesome. Well, Mike, enjoy it.
We'll do that.
This has been The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. This week's show produced by myself and Sabrina Boyd-Circa. Matt Leon's going to be back next week. I'm Brian Seltzer. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend.